You're listening to the Empowered Caregiver Show, where we uplift caregivers through education and support while also lifting up their invaluable role in society. I'm Liza.
And I'm Kristen, and together we are the Empowered Caregivers. We are here this morning with Lance Robertson, the Director of Health at an organization named Guidehouse. Lance is also a United States Army veteran, university administrator, and government official who formerly served as an Assistant Secretary of Health and Human Services in Aging. In there, he was also the Chief of the Administration of Community Living. The ACL has a mission for advancing independence, integration, and inclusion throughout life. Woo, what a resume. Lance, welcome.
Hey, good morning. It's good to be with both of you.
Thanks for taking the time to join us today.
Thanks for joining us today to really break down those various governmental programs and actions that are being done to support family caregivers. So our first question is really getting down to trying to break down for the listeners and for us all of these different names that I just read in your bio, right? So could you first explain who the Administration of Community Living is?
Absolutely, Kristen. And listen, I get it. You know, the federal government structure, the system is, it's enormous. And it does take a little bit of time and effort to fully understand kind of what's going on there. But I think it's imperative for your listeners, not only because of these supports that we know the federal government continues to provide to family caregivers, but let's be honest, we're all taxpayers. So it's good to know, sure, where's your money going? What are we investing exactly in? So the Administration for Community Living is a relatively new federal agency. It's about 10 years old. We actually just are celebrating our 10-year anniversary. And it's one of 11 operating divisions in the behemoth Department of Health and Human Services. So HHS, for context, is a $1.6 trillion agency, one of the largest in all of federal.
Okay, and so when you say 1.6 trillion, let me interrupt you for a sec. Are you saying people that are working or money, tax dollars that are going there?
No, money.
Money,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so like most federal agencies, there's about 90,000 staff that work for HHS, but the majority of the work is subcontracted. So like at ACL, we only had about 200 staff, but our roughly $5 billion budget all went out the door to grantees who then delivered services. So it's almost like if you thought about the analogy of a corporate structure, you have HHS as the flagship corporation, and then underneath that, 11 subsidiary businesses. And one of those would be ACL, the Administration for Community Living, which I think has the best mission in all of federal government. Its purpose is to help create, again, as you said, independence and opportunity for older adults and people with disabilities, roughly 110 million Americans.
Wow.
Wow. And now that we have a clearer understanding of the organization, can you explain your role within it?
Absolutely. Yeah, so it was my honor to lead the organization. So I was called to DC in 2017. The role that I played was a bifurcated role. I was the U.S. Assistant Secretary on Aging, the fifth one in the nation's history. And that position required Senate confirmation. So I had to go through that whole, if you've ever watched the Senate confirmation process, delight. So that was one role. And then the other role was as the administrator of ACL. So you also then are an agency head. And, you know, it's important to point out the bifurcation because you have different reporting responsibilities and you have different, the different roles do bear obviously different initiatives and things that you're responsible for.
Okay. And I need you to clarify, what's bifurcation?
Oh, two different jobs. So you're kind of wearing two hats.
Okay. Okay. Great. And now that I have to have a vocabulary check, and clearly I need a math lesson if I really thought there was 1.6 trillion people on the planet. Oh, I realized that mistake after you started talking. I'm like, of course it had to be money. But now let's get into a little bit about kind of the reason why you're here, right? So we reached out because we know the ACL has assisted in this Raise Family Caregiving Act, right? And part of doing that, in all of the research I can find, there's a council that's reporting to Congress. Is that correct?
Well, it reports to the HHS secretary.
Okay. And then, but I'm really confused about what is the actual report that's been created, the actual group. Well, I guess the group is obvious. It's the people. But what is this report? And then do we actually have a piece of legislation? Is there an act that got passed?
Right. So let's break it down. And first of all, at ACL, I just want us to be mindful that sure. as a federal agency, they have about 36 different programs that they're responsible for. So the okay. services that are offered to family caregivers represents one of about 36 different efforts. And I point that out just so there's an acknowledgement of really the enormity of what federal agencies deliver on. I personally am such a big fan of family caregivers. I think this is the one of the most important things that ACL does.
Sure.
So really the particular activity we're talking about today was initiated and is driven by a piece of legislation that was passed in 2017 that created the act, created the council, and as all legislation does, it sort of laid out some expectations. So that's Congress saying, okay, this is what we want done, and now we're going to assign a federal agency to deliver.
Okay.
So it was, of course, assigned to HHS and then, of course, proxied to ACL, which makes sense because we do most of the work around family caregiver support. And if you go back and read the actual law, which isn't lengthy, and for those that are really interested or just find that sort of thing exciting, you know, that piece of legislation's, I think, well-written. And also, I think that, you know, it helps people understand the framework behind this activity.
Okay.
So essentially, what the legislation required was that HHS set up a council, and that meant we took applications. There's a formal process for everything. So there's a process to have folks submit to be considered. Then, of course, we screened them, and then eventually they're nominated by the HHS secretary to serve on this council.
Okay.
Then once a council's assembled, the council's primary operative is to put together this strategy, this plan.
Okay.
So, and that seems simple, but it's a lot of work. I mean, there's a lot of time investment, and then, of course, they have subcommittees, and at the end of the day, they put together a report. And we call it a report because that means it hasn't actually gone through the formal approval process yet.
Okay.
So the report goes to Congress for feedback.
Okay.
So that happened just recently. And of course, I'm sure the federal agency is still waiting on feedback because that process takes a while.
Sure.
And, you know, my role in the former administration as administrator was to chair this council and to make sure that the council stayed on track, which I have to be honest, Krista, I'm super excited to tell you they did. Despite the pandemic.
Right.
So even though COVID was going on, the council was still willing to meet and we still advanced that important work because we all agreed caregivers can't wait. I mean, who knew how long the pandemic was going to last and we couldn't
exactly.
just stop this work.
Right.
So I hope that helps kind of at a high level, give you a little bit of an understanding of that process.
It does. And on just a quick local level or more like to the ground, what's happening with that report and those recommendations today? You said they're kind of waiting for the feedback. So does that mean any of these goals are being accomplished? Or I guess not accomplished because of course they're not being finished, but is anyone actually working towards these goals or are we waiting to get all of the feedback from the different players?
Yeah, so here's the inside baseball answer to that.
Okay.
Yes, there are recommendations. There are 26 recommendations in the report.
Right.
And the majority of them are at some level happening already.
Okay.
What we try to do in the report is draw out for Congress where more support is needed. So sometimes a report doesn't come up with all these brand new ideas. Sometimes it's a reinforcement of what we know is working and we just need more money, more support.
Okay.
So to your question, some of that is still happening. Now, you know, the home run, to use that baseball analogy and carry it through, you know, the home run is to make sure that Congress delivers. And
okay.
that's what we're all hoping for, is that Congress sees the value of this report, the value of where that investment could pay off for American caregivers. And then we see, as a result, higher appropriations, maybe more legislation that changes laws or policies
sure.
that need to be amended. Those are the sort of actions that really rest with Congress.
Okay. That was helpful. Thank you.
And this seems like a very bipartisan issue. It just feels like it's something that everybody can get behind. I mean, do you feel optimistic?
Absolutely. And that was one of the blessings of being in charge of an agency that served older adults and people with disabilities. Very little of what we ever did got caught up in that political spin because most everybody appreciates that as constituents, as voters, as Americans, These are often marginalized populations, and yet we've got to do something to better support them.
Exactly.
As we'll talk about later in the interview, their independence has tremendous ramifications on a lot of things, from the budget to just the health of society, and then, of course, ultimately, how the individual is able to live and enjoy their lives.
Definitely. Liza, do you want to start getting into asking him some of our specific questions?
Yeah, we have a few minutes left, but there's one striking statistic that came out. According to the ACL, by 2040, there'll be more than 80.8 million people over the age of 65, more than twice as many as there was in 2000. It's very clear that we are not well equipped as a nation to handle this rising increase in the elderly and the caregivers that support them. From your perspective, what needs to be done immediately and what needs to be done in the long term? And that's a big question, so we can break it down and come back to it.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. And it is a common question, Liza. I was in more than one congressional testimony experience where that question was asked of me. So, there's not one silver bullet. However, I think the progress we're making in supporting community living is the answer. People who are served in the community, the health outcomes are better, the cost is less, and at the end of the day, it's a win-win because that's what they prefer. Okay. So there's an unprecedented level of support right now for serving people in their homes and in their community, and that just has to continue to be kind of the mainstay support that we chase.
Okay, so that's both the long-term and the short-term? It's just have to keep emphasizing how important it is to, and what is it about being in your community? Why is that so essential?
Yeah, I think for a variety of reasons, it's just the most fulfilling place to live. You have those around you who you love, the environment's familiar to you. And again, it always, research validates, indicates better health outcomes.
Okay. Well, excellent. That's really insightful. And I'm looking forward to getting into more details about these goals as we come back from the break. You're listening to The Empowered Caregiver with Liza Lance Robertson and myself, Kristen. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Empowered Caregiver Show. We are here today with Lance Robertson, who is the former Assistant Secretary of Health and Human Services and Aging.
Thank you. Lance, we're breaking down the different goals and focuses to the RAISE Family Caregiving Act, but we have a couple of questions before that are still keeping us kind of in the bird's eye, the big picture, right? And so research shows that replacing family caregivers with paid services would cost, and this is where I'm going to get my numbers, more accurate, right? Would cost an estimated $470 billion each year. So that means that currently our family caregivers are providing that without having that money be spent, right? And it also means that if we're shouldering that bill, what needs to be done to raise awareness about this incredible burden so taxpayers see the need to support caregivers? Because I think a lot of the problem is this only starts to become a reality for you if you have an adult child with a disability. Well, even if you have a child with a disability, but it also doesn't really become something that you're aware of until your parents are aging and you start having to make some tough decisions. And we can't wait for people, for taxpayers to feel it, on their own personal level to understand how important it is. So what do you think we need to do to raise that awareness?
Well, I think you touched on it, Kristen. Obviously, the way that this issue becomes serious to those in the highest levels of leadership is when it becomes personal. Mm-hmm. And, we can throw data and white papers at them all day long, but until it becomes personal, it's just hard to resonate with them, the potential impact, because, again, I think about all the work that I've done with members of Congress. I mean, the number of issues that they deal with on a daily basis can be unfathomable. And, they can't fix everything. And this is an issue that is an enormous one. As you said, $470 billion in economic value that this informal caregiver network continues to provide, that if these individuals had to be cared for, again, in a more acute, formalized setting, would just bankrupt America.
Exactly.
But that's not going to happen. And leaders know that. Mm-hmm. So what they try to do is soft play it a bit, and where can they find the right balance with family responsibilities, but then also where can we contribute as taxpayers? I think the most encouraging conversation, of course, involves some sort of framework where we can actually compensate or pay family caregivers for some of the work that's offered. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think anyone believes that it should be a full compensation, because that's just, number one, probably not economically sustainable. And that can be a little tricky for somebody who provides the informal support that, say, already works, to quit their current job to become a paid caregiver, because maybe not everybody wants to do that. But some level of compensation or cost offset could be helpful. Yes. I also think through the tax code, there's a lot of opportunity to help make sure that family caregivers have direct costs acknowledged by the federal government when it comes to taxation. And there are a variety of other options that are out there, some of which are in the report, if you read mm-hmm. the report.
I have.
That really offers ways, again, in which I think our country could move towards being more supportive. It's not going to be an overnight change, but I think we're making the right steps. We just need to accelerate that a bit, in my opinion.
Okay. Thank you.
And shifting gears a little bit, the Kaiser, if I'm saying that correctly, Family Foundation noted that there's 820,000 people that are on waiting list for home and community-based service waivers. And I know that you mentioned earlier that that's really where we want these individuals to be, within their homes and communities. And I'm sure that this number has only greatly increased during the pandemic. What recommendations do you have to combat the paid caregiver crisis?
Yeah, so the figure you're quoting, and Kaiser's a wonderful resource. For those that really want to dig deep into health policy, I would recommend Kaiser Family Foundation. The reality is the Medicaid waivers that report's referencing, of course, are controlled by states. The higher percentage of the match when it comes to cost does come from the federal government, CMS, but states make those decisions, and waiting lists are often created for a variety of reasons, most commonly of which is budget. You know, at the end of the day, states don't have open checkbooks where they can just write and cover whatever costs exist. So states have to make tough choices. And I had to do that when I was an administrator, state of Oklahoma. You know, you have to sort of determine which cohort you plan to serve, and then what those services are going to look like, and what does a provider network look like. And there's just a lot of different variables there. So I don't know if the answer of paying family caregivers would actually impact the wait list directly, but I think that we all know intuitively, if there's a way that we can help compensate or cover some of that financial burden that family caregivers are experiencing, I think undoubtedly we would see lower numbers on wait lists. And I think we would also see greater independence for those that are being cared for. And honestly, I think health indicators would increase. I think that, you know, families would do better, and then the person that they're caring for would do better if there was some sort of cost burden offset.
Can I push back a little bit, or I guess ask you to follow up on, why do you think that would increase independence, though?
Well, because I think that for a lot of families, and I know we're going to get in a little bit into questions around just people being aware of what's out there, right?
Yeah, well, that's actually my next question, so we could lead right into it.
Okay, sure.
So go ahead. I think what I'm still not quite seeing the connection that, I mean, I feel it because I live it, but I'm not sure I understand how the RAISE report has really helped point out what can be done to raise the awareness for people themselves who don't even understand they're in this role. Right.
Well, so, right. No, I'm actually, I'll counteract your point there, because I actually think the RAISE report does a fabulous job of pointing out how we can better educate Americans on what options are out there. And I'll give you, I think one of the most promising examples involves partnerships. How do we make sure that certain critical influencers in society better understand where to direct family caregivers? A great example is the faith-based community. There are so many families who experience a caregiving situation, and the first person they go to often is their church leader. and research shows this, the majority of church leaders aren't sure where to direct that family person.
Of course.
Where are the local resources? What do they need to focus on? Okay. So one of the recommendations is to focus on those types of partnerships where we can put in place a wide variety of champions who will help that family caregiver navigate the system.
Okay. That makes sense. And then can you give one more example? Because I think I can see that, right? So I'm recognizing that I'm now taking care of my sick elderly parents, and I'm now, you know, have this extra burden of being a family caregiver while I'm still having my own children. I'm a full-time teacher, you know, blah, 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 blah. Going to my priest or going to, you know, a faith-based organization to lean on for support, if he or she, you know, could then direct me to resources, that's super helpful. But what if I'm not religious, or what if that's not where I chose to go? Who else can sort of support me in that fashion?
And addressed in the council report, and I think the biggest area for all of us would be the working environment, employers. Mm-hmm. Because they're going to also be the ones that have to deal with this directly. And traditionally, many of them are used to childcare related issues,
true,
but very few of them are aware of elder care related issues.
Right.
So I think the workplace is ripe for some modernization around how can we better support some of our stellar employees who are having to also balance at home caregiving responsibilities. You know, could we look at alternative work schedules? Could we do some, you know, work from home sort of opportunities? And how do we wrap around that caregiver, knowing that oftentimes these are temporary situations? So don't lose a good employee over a family caregiving situation.
Exactly.
Walk alongside them and help them find a good alternative.
Sure, that makes sense.
And I think I was just going to add, I think the pandemic really showed that a lot of that is possible if anything was good to come out of it. You're listening to the Empowered Caregiver Show. We'll be right back after this short break.
This is the Empowered Caregiving Show, and we are with Lance Robertson discussing the Raised Family Caregiver Act and some of the goals that they're trying to bring to light through congressional support and working with family caregivers. So if we dive into goal two, Lance, that one is the way I'm reading it. It's a huge one. So we tried to just really boil it down to what its key point was, which is that we need to make family caregivers key partners with providers of healthcare and long-term services and support. The AARP, the National Alliance for Caregiving, they state that about 65% of caregivers report communicating with doctors on behalf of their family members. Yet they are not universally identified in health records, and in many systems do not have access to the electronic health records. And I also know personally, I'm going through this right now, a lot of times the hospitals can be more concerned about the legality than building a partnership or being on the team. It seems like it should be an easy fix, right? Train the medical profession to see caregivers as part of the care team. What do you think are the challenges in making this happen?
Yeah, so I think there are two issues, Kristen, and both of them are sort of longstanding difficulties. And the first does, I think, put front and center the whole PII, the personally identifiable information issue around health records and your right to privacy as an individual receiving care. And that even includes making the decisions about which family members know about your current condition and your care treatment and all those sorts of things. So tied to the first one has to be a continued emphasis on this whole person-centeredness, where we don't lose focus, even though we want to engage caregivers, we don't lose focus on the fact that this individual receiving care has rights, because we have to be careful. In far too many cases, families overstep the patient's wishes.
Okay.
So we just have to make sure that we strike that balance, because before too long, all of a sudden, in many examples, you know, the daughter is calling the healthcare shots for the mother, who actually is perfectly capable, but whose voice has kind of been taken away because everybody wants to support the caregiver. So
right.
My focus has always been on the care recipient, making sure that to the maximum extent possible, that person-centeredness remains the focus. And then I think on the second issue is just as the field of medicine modernizes and, you know, people start to embrace better ways of caring for individuals, we are seeing greater strides now than ever in making this a reality in terms of sharing this responsibility appropriately with the caregiver. So as an example, in Oklahoma, the first state to pass the BOLD Act, B-O-L-D, requires that upon discharge at a hospital, particularly for somebody that's facing dementia, they actually have to, by law, ask that individual to identify who the primary care recipient will be, primary caregiver will be. And then they have to involve that caregiver.
That took a lot of work.
And many states have now adopted that law, that language, which I think is, while very focused, is a step in the right direction.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I like being reminded that it really is supposed to be focused on the care recipient, right? And not taking their rights away. I know when I'm in the overwhelm of being the caregiver, I'm focused on what I need. And I try to respect the voice and the rights and the needs of the person I'm taking care of. But that can be challenging because it's like, I want to be more efficient. I want to think big picture. And in theory, I can say it's important to value that person's rights, but it doesn't always necessarily get played out that way in practice. So thank you for giving me that reminder. I think it's a good one.
And I'll be honest, as a career gerontologist, Kristen, more times than I can count, families will come to me with solutions. And the first thing I'll ask is, well, what does your care recipient want? And they look at me with this blank look like, well, we haven't really asked him or her. Well, you really need to circle back and start there.
Right.
Because while you're developing solutions which seem very palatable to you, what if they don't like that? Mm-hmm. What if they don't want to move from where they're at and come live with you, as one example?
Right.
So
exactly.
That's an excellent point. And with both of us having children with intellectual disability, that you really see that a lot. You start making decisions for these folks without really finding out what it is they want. I'm going to switch gears a little bit. One other recommendation in goal 2 is to better engage family caregivers by using assessments to determine their ability to handle this role and what supports they need to make this caregiver-caree relationship successful. The report had mentioned that other countries are doing this. And again, this one seems kind of like an easy fix. Why do you think that we're not doing this here in the U.S.? And then how can caregivers advocate for these assessments?
Yeah, so the purpose behind the assessment is just a recognition that one size doesn't fit all. We need to make sure that in some instances, caregivers are either ill-equipped financially, or maybe they have career obligations, maybe they have child care obligations. Mm-hmm. All of that needs to be assessed, evaluated, factored in before you turn over a higher level of responsibility for elder care to that individual. And I think in our country, the struggle has always been just the cultural difference in terms of how we address elder care. You know, as you probably know, there are countries in other parts of the world where elders are respected, and actually families build future obligations around the care needs of that older adult. Here in America, for a variety of reasons, we just haven't been wired that way. I think elder care is often sort of a response, something that is addressed reactively instead of proactively. And that's where I think the secret sauce is making sure that we help Americans appreciate doing this right and being proactive about it can really create a pathway so much more manageable than if you simply just keep putting it off and kicking a can down the road. And, you know, even with perfectly healthy older adults, we encourage people to have very critical conversations now around care needs and maybe even end of life and, you know, do all of that while the person's healthy and has great mental capacity. And that's the best time to actually have those conversations. Don't wait until everything has gone so dramatically downhill that you're just trying to pick from a whole bunch of bad options.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. And something that we learned in our family. And so then I've also encouraged a lot of my friends to try to have those tough conversations.
It'd be nice though, if somebody could help facilitate that, you know, if there was a good go-to person. I remember when my son turned 18 and we had to make all of these changes for him, I sent all of the information to my parents, you know, who his IRIS provider is and different things that they should know in if I was to pass. And I got a phone call like, are you okay? You know, are you dying? And I'm like, no, but this is stuff that you guys need to know. And I've put it all together and here it is. So I know sometimes those can be uncomfortable. So it would be great if there was a resource or a support around helping families have those conversations.
Yep, definitely. Goal three is about recognizing that there is a wide variety of family caregivers, right? So we have people from all different kinds of ethnic and cultural backgrounds, different ages, different, you know, I try to bring up how it tends to disproportionately fall on women, but there are plenty of men that actually end up being family caregivers as well, especially as our workforce is becoming more diverse in terms of, you know, women progressing further in their careers. So you have to make the hard choice if you have to start cutting back from work. Well, who's got the either higher paying job or the job with more benefits? That was what happened in my family. So I stayed the full-time caregiver and my husband cut back on his work so that he could be, I stayed the full-time wage earner and he cut back on his work so he could be more of the caregiver. So clearly there's a wide variety, right? And their needs are huge. The mental health needs of Americans in general have been increasing for quite some time. We've already established there's a heightened risk of depression and anxiety in the caregiver community, as we've talked about in other shows. How do we make sure that we are developing and providing evidence-based programs that are for family caregivers themselves?
Mm-hmm. Well, and I have to tell you, starting 25 years ago, that was always my mantra. Mm-hmm. I started a program at Oklahoma State called Replenishing the Caregiver, which focused entirely on the caregiver, not the care recipient, because burnout rates are atrocious. And then, of course, the health indicators do demonstrate that caregivers oftentimes themselves become ill or financially strained. I mean, all these sorts of outcomes that if a better plan's in place, particularly for replenishment and respite yourself, then, of course, that's going to lead to better outcomes. One of the programs that we do fund at the federal level is a respite program that's designed to help caregivers step away, replenish themselves before they have to pick that duty right back up. And those vouchers that are used in that program help pay for somebody else to step in during that time. And I can't stress enough, most family caregivers go into a situation thinking that they're just going to manage all of it, that they'll be able to handle it, that their shoulders are broad enough, sure, and that their capabilities are significant enough to manage the crisis at hand. And oftentimes that's just a failure of proper planning and acknowledging that that this often takes a team. You need to be talking right up front about who will be your backup, who's going to help you do certain things, and then how you're going to manage the overall experience for the one that you love. Because at the same time, people fail to acknowledge what value is it if the person you care for is doing okay, but yet your health goes down the toilet. And then all of a sudden you've taken a situation where there's one person in poor health and now you've made it two people in poor health. And that's not the goal of these programs and why we support family caregivers.
Right. That's an excellent point. And we had a guest last week. We always ask this question, what is one thing that you would want all caregivers to know? And almost everyone says that you are not alone. And this particular person said, you can't do this alone, which isn't an insult, but just such a good reminder. If I was to tell you I was going to open a restaurant and be the hostess, the waiter, the server, the cook, the business manager, you would look at me like I'm crazy. Yet this can be a full or part-time job, and a lot of people just assume that they can take it on their own.
Yep. Goal four hits home for both of us because it addresses how family caregivers' lifetime financial and employment security needs to be protected and enhanced. Liza really recognized it when she realized that her Social Security had been greatly impacted due to the fact that she was a caregiver for her son and had to take herself out of the workforce for periods of time. For me, it's been an incredible challenge. Like I just said, I kept that professional job because I had the better benefits, but I also am wanting to be really involved in Nicole's care. And both of those are full-time jobs, right? So what do you feel are some of the best recommendations to address how to protect our financial and employment needs? You just talked about our own personal, like mental health, make a team, but what are some things that we can do to actually help us in that financial realm as well?
And that's a critical one, and that's a big part of the Raise report. And I'm sure you've read that really, again, separates out this matter into kind of two issues. One does have to do with congressional levers, things that Congress could do around Social Security and other programs. And again, I think that cannot be overlooked. Now, that's not going to be an easy ship to turn overnight. Those are big conversations to have, but so critical. I think the other is a workforce-specific one. How can employers actually lean in to help create some sort of resiliency and support for their working caregivers who they value, and they want to make sure that they stay with the company long term? And yet so few of them actually step in to help with this kind of short-term obligation of taking care of things and what that financial burden looks like.
Excellent point. And we'll come back right after this short break to talk a little bit more about specifically what could employers do. You're listening to the Empowered Caregiver Show. I'm Kristen. I'm here with my co-host Liza and our guest Lance Robertson. We've been talking about some of the specific goals that the Raise Family Caregiver Act has put before Congress as a way to deal with our family caregiver crisis. Right before the break, we were talking about how one of the things that is important for family caregivers is to protect their financial well-being, and that can be challenging. And you mentioned that one of the possibilities for solution is getting some support through the government and the tax code and, you know, Social Security, that kind of thing. But that's going to take a long time because that's going to involve a lot of key partners and a lot of dialogue. What you ended with, though, is this idea that this isn't just going to be something that the government can fix, right? We also need employers to understand how to support people that they value as their employees, but who are getting, you know, pulled in a lot of different directions. So Lance, do you have anything that's come to mind from your experience or different things you've heard about techniques that employers should keep in mind when they're dealing with somebody who is a family caregiver?
Yeah, there are a few shining practices out there, and I will say MetLife has been a champion of supporting caregivers in the workplace. That's a good resource for people to go to. But if you think about the value proposition and the return on investment, if you're a company, you have a great employee like Kristen, and you don't want to lose her. You don't want to lose her, but you know that she's experiencing a challenging caregiving situation for the immediate future. How do you manage that? Well, I mean, there are lots of great ideas, and there's really no limit to the number of things companies could do. It's just a matter of where does that fall on their list of priorities, and are they willing to invest? Sure. So a great example, I think probably the most prominent example is, you know, could you create a paid leave system for caregivers at your company so that rather than have to take sick leave or vacation leave for caregiving responsibilities, you actually have a designated code that means I'm being a family caregiver today and I need today off. Mm-hmm. Because what happens, of course, is that caregivers have to burn all of that vacation and sick leave. And then when it's time to take a vacation, they have no leave.
Yep.
And they have to use all that leave to be a caregiver.
Right.
I think another profoundly opportunistic thing to look at would be, you know, something like at your corporation, a respite pool, where mm-hmm. you actually could say, okay, you know, would there be a group of us willing to help out Kristen in her situation? Maybe it's not direct care, but maybe I go and mow her lawn. So right. That's one less thing Kristen has to do. Maybe I go get her groceries for her. Maybe there's a way to support her that saves her time, reduces her stress, and actually contributes to the overall situation. It doesn't mean that, you know, I go into the home and I actually do transferring or bathing or anything that really needs to be left up to Kristen. But there are lots of things that you're having to also manage that, you know, fellow employees could actually contribute with if there was a structure, a system in place.
Yeah,
you know, that's sort of like when people sign up to bring meals to somebody that's just lost a loved one. Well, again, why do we wait until something that significant and life altering happens before we lean in?
Yeah. And I can't let this pass by without pointing out that I work for the Madison School District. And one of the first times I had a family caregiving crisis and had to take, I'm fortunate to be able to take time off like you described, but it did go from my sick leave. The social worker at the school understood what was going on. And she just informally created exactly what you talked about. And people showed up and took care of some of my household needs in terms of like fixing some stuff that hadn't been fixed and carrying things and mowing the lawn. And it brought me to tears because I didn't ask for it, and it showed, and they showed up, they took care of it, and they just went on their merry way and said, this is what we do for one another. So I think you're right. We could put those kind of things formally and even informally, just teach HR people how beneficial that could be.
Well, and think about it, Kristen, if you were the CEO of a company, what sort of differentiator could you put out there that would be stronger than saying, we're a caregiver-friendly company? Yeah. Because everybody's facing these elder care needs, and nobody yet is really addressing it and advertising that. Then all of a sudden, if you're trying to recruit the best and brightest, and we all know there's a workforce issue across all conversations,
exactly,
a big differentiator could be, you know what, I'm going to go to your company because I know when I have care needs for my aging mother, you're going to be there for me.
Yeah, exactly. Excellent point.
Yeah, that is so huge. And especially if one in five Americans are a caregiver at some point, you know, you have the ability to like you said, draw in the best and brightest to your corporation if that's something that you can offer. And again, it sounds like an easy fix. Some of these just sound like, why aren't we doing this already? I'm going to shift gears a little bit. At the end of every show, we like to ask what we call as the powerful questions that kind of force you to go inward and reflect on some of your personal experiences. And the first one that we have for you, Lance, is what drew you into this line of work?
Well, I was raised by my grandparents, and I had an affinity early on to really try to contribute and make a difference. So I've been a public sector guy for 25 of my 26 working years, and all of that was directed at, again, being able to contribute to the greater good where I could.
Excellent. Well, and it's interesting that you brought that up, because as we were doing a deep dive into your resume, we were recognizing that you've been mostly in the public sector. And now, is the current position you're in the private sector?
Correct.
Okay. And so how do you think we can get public and private to talk together and work together? Because this is a crisis that goes across all divisions of every kind in this country.
Yeah. And I would say, broadly speaking, to the conversation we had a little bit ago, there's just a ripe opportunity within the general employer market for us to be more caregiver centric. And I think, again, those ideas aren't tremendously complex or costly. Companies just have to make it a priority. So I think the private sector side at any point should be ready to really step up and take on that role as a champion. The good news in the work I do now, even though it's private sector, we help mostly public sector organizations, and we get to drive a lot of different policy and key program opportunities that I have found continue to help caregivers, which has been so rewarding for me. So even though I'm on the private sector side, I get to really influence some things, I think, very positively for Americans.
Excellent.
And what is one message that you would like to give to all caregivers?
Well, I think, like we discussed earlier in the show, it is absolutely about caring for yourself, putting together a manageable plan, and making sure that from the beginning, you address your own needs as well. And that could be, of course, physically, but personally and professionally, and just making sure that this particular family situation doesn't divert you from what you know to be important, and then certainly to make sure that your health is maintained throughout it all. It's tough because it seems selfish to try to focus on that, but it's a necessity for the overall effort.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. And real quickly, Lance, what do you want your legacy to be?
Just to continue to help family caregivers and to continue that work over the last 2.5 decades.
That's excellent. Thank you for everything you've done in this field and for giving us your time. You've got to be a fairly busy man, so we really appreciate it. We were first connected to you through Denise Brown, the founder of the Caregiving Years Training Academy. We're going to be working with her at our own virtual town hall later this month. Do you know much about these virtual town halls?
I do.
All right, great. And we're excited to have ours, and we hope that you help us promote it. It's going to be Saturday, May 21st, and it'll be from 9 to 10 a.m.
Thank you, Lance.
It's been a real treat. Take care, everybody. We'll see you next week.